Welcome to University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland. Thanksgiving, the 4th of July, those are great times to celebrate American music, but any day will do. And so we will be doing a survey, a 200-year survey of American song in the hour to come, and it will feature Trevor Stevenson at the piano and his talented quartet of singers.
To Anacreon in Ham, where he sat in full glee, a few sons of harmony sent a petition that he their inspirer and patron would be. When this answer arrived from the jolly old Grecian, voice, fiddle, and flute, no longer be mute. I'll lend you my name and inspire you to boot. And besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus's vine. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? O'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Is it my imagination, Trevor, or was it a lot easier to sing as a drinking song?
it's probably harder without a ballpark around, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
It's amazing that it's the same song, right?
Yeah.
With a few accidentals changed here and there.
Right. Not the official national anthem until 1931, so a lot of time to make those changes over the years.
Right. So it begins in its first form as an English gentleman's club song with, written by William Stafford Smith. And those are the original words. They're, of course, something like 10 or 12 verses to it, which I'm sure they just went on and on, you know, winding up as they went.
Did you
and
say and winding up or winding up?
Winding up, and lots of, yeah. I mean, it's all about Bacchus. And Anacreon, right, the god of having a good time, or at least an early poet of having a good time. So that tune is in the air and is quite well known when Francis Scott Key in 1812, while he's watching the Battle of Fort McHenry, he writes his own poem, which we know as the Star-Spangled Banner, to that existing tune, Anacreon in Heaven. And so that's how it all gets fused together. It's called a parody technique, writing new words to old tunes. And so everybody would have been able to jump on board, but as you said, not till the 1930s does it become a national anthem. Yeah.
Well, before we go further, introduce our talented singers.
Yes, it's just a joyous week here. I'll start here on this end with bass Michael Hawes. He's from Chicago. We're just thrilled he came up to Madison for this fun few days. Thank you, Michael. And next to him is Nola Richardson, soprano from New York City. We've worked together a lot, and just thanks for jumping on an airplane and coming out. And next to her is mezzo alto Clara Osowski from Minneapolis, and actually just back from England, so that was a lot of flying for you as well. And Scott Brunsheen, who lives now in Des Moines, he's singing tenor. He's lived all over the place and is now teaching at Drake in Des Moines.
Well, let's stay in the 18th century for a while. There was American music, other than, of course, To Anacreon in Heaven and the Star-Spangled Banner,
right,
being composed in the 18th century, and some real colorful characters emerge, don't they?
We'll start with William Billings and two pieces by him, one called The Bird, which is a very religious text, a beautiful poem. Why I'm like a bird always flying from God, even though God is trying to take care of me. And then the second one is called Africa. The name has nothing to do with the text. It's just a simply very evangelical Isaac Watts text. So Africa doesn't play in it. But that was something they liked to do, kind of have puzzling titles to pieces. It was a game. William Billings was quite a character. He's born in 1746. He's a Bostonian. He's not particularly educated. He's self-taught as a musician. He's a tanner by trade. He was one of the most asymmetrical looking people ever, with one short leg and one eye, and with snuff paraphernalia dangling all over him. He was completely addicted to snuff. Apparently not particularly elegant of speech either, except when he talked music, the people say, you knew you were talking to a real musician.
And some of it sounds a little, even to our ears today, a little avant-garde, some of those pieces by Billings.
He wrote pieces that have quite pungent dissonances deliberately interjected into them, a little bit as a precursor to the great Charles Ives, who we'll get to later. So maybe it's just in the American water.
And then we also have Quakers.
Right, and then after the Billings pieces, we'll have two Quaker tunes, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, and then My Life Flows On, an Endless Song, and that's followed by a Shaker tune, Give Good Gifts. Those are all part of the great 19th century American religious revivals. The 19th century was really a strong time for that, and the music is spectacular, so we'll sample them.
Since I have placed my trust in God, a refuge always nigh, why should I, like a timorous bird, to distant mountains fly?
Why should I shy?
Why should I shed those tears to distant mountains fly? To should I stay to distant mountains, to
and burst into a song. Almighty love inspires my heart, and pleasure tunes my tongue. God on his thirsty Zion's hill some mercy drops as throne, and Solomon mopes have bound his love to shower salvation down. Deep on the palms of both my hands I have engraved her name. My hand shall raise her ruined walls and build her broken frame. Of mercy never ceasing, cover songs of loudest praise. While the hope of life's perfection fills our hearts with joy and love, teach us ever to be faithful, may we still thy goodness prove. Come, thou fount of every vision,
lift our eyes to what may come. See the lion and the young lamb dwell together in thy home. Hear the cries of mortal silent, feel the love glow like the sun. When we all serve one another, then our heaven is begun.
Lovely stuff. You know, there's one star up here that we haven't talked about yet.
Yes. Who is this here? And is it even American? And the answer is no. It's a European import. This is an 1855, circa 1855, Viennese Burzendorfer piano that made its way here, actually, probably in the 1970s or 80s. Its magic is that it's all wooden in construction. It has no metal plate in it. So it is a kind of a massive guitar in a way. There's just two little struts in there. It also has the old German action in it, which is still an 18th century style forte piano action with a very, very responsive. It's a very quick action, but you can hear quite a mellow sound and many different registers. The top and the bottom and everything in between sound more like soprano, tenor, alto, and bass. Those zones are there. It's a long story about how it got here. We don't have time for it, but it ended up in Milwaukee in the 1980s, and along with about 40 other of these instruments. I spent about 2 years rebuilding this and restringing it and with period wire and hammer parts and things like that. So we're so glad, you know, and you can see it's made from the age of just love of wood. It was just the wood grain is magnificent. I'm trying to think of anything. Oh, I guess the man who made it, Ignaz Burzendorfer, ran the factory. He was at the end of his life when this was made in the 1850s. When he started in the around 1810, 1815, making pianos in Vienna, Beethoven and Schubert would have been their clients, you know. So this is kind of a rear guard action. 1850s instrument, but really looking back and really to the late 18th century aesthetic. It's just really fun to play, and we've been moving it around a lot.
And contemporary with our next composer by one of those remarkable coincidences of history, July 4th, 1826.
Right.
John Adams dies, Thomas Jefferson dies. It's the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, and Stephen Foster is born.
Is born on the same day.
All the same day.
So, what, July 4th?
1826.
1826, right. So, a good day, yeah. And Foster is born just in near Pittsburgh, which a lot of people don't know. He always seems like a Mason-Dixon composer,
sure.
You know. But he is a Northerner, and he makes a living as a songwriter for quite some time. One of his first big hits is Oh Susanna, which we'll be doing in this next set.
About 1847.
Right. He's publishing, he's doing all right. He's a very careful, he works quite carefully. He's not a performer. Mm-hmm. He likes to write songs, and of course his tunes are largely lifted from people he would have heard. I mean, that borrowing was perfectly fine. But I think his magic is he wrote his own words, and he was able to make the words really add up to the tune, to what they were saying, and that fusion is what we respond to. Besides the tunes themselves being great, there's something about the way the words are working as well.
And they would have been particularly poignant, a lot of them, for people of his time. Hard times come again no more. Certainly
right.
People were familiar with hard times in this country
right.
in the 1850s and 60s. And
right.
You mentioned Oh Susanna, which is one of his most buoyant
right.
tunes.
He actually at one point said that Hard Times was his favorite of his own songs, or the one that he enjoyed.
Possibly he could relate to it most, as they say.
And just one other thing, that the last song we'll be doing of the Stephen Foster set is called the Voices That Are Gone. And he wrote it during the Civil War. Things are, of course, the country is in extreme crisis, and the music business is also in crisis. Publishing is really going away. He's writing some war songs, which are not his strong suit. But he writes this beautiful, ghostly poem, The Voices That Are Gone, and sets it in the key of C major, which in the old tuning systems that we have on here today, C major was the most kind of unreal sounding of all keys, the purest in many ways. So we'll
end with that. I think Jeannie will put in an appearance too.
Yes, I dream of Jeannie with light brown hair. She will be here as well.
Right. Let us pause in life's pleasures and count its many tears, while we all sup sorrow with the poor. There's a song that will linger forever in our ears. Oh, hard times come again no more.
'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times, come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again.
Troubled wave, 'tis a wail that is heard upon the shore. 'Tis a dirge that is murmured around the lowly grave. Oh, hard times come again no more.
'Tis the song, the sigh of the weary. Hard times come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times come again. Thank you.
from Alabama with my banjo on my knee. And I'm going to Louisiana, my true love for to see. It rained all night the day I left, the weather, it was dry. The sun so hot, I froze to death. Susanna, don't you cry.
Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. 'Cause I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee.
Everything was still. I thought I saw Susanna dear coming down the hill. A red, red rose was in her hand, a tear was in her eye. I said, I come from Dixieland. Susanna, don't you cry.
Oh, Susanna, don't you cry for me. 'Cause I come from Alabama with my banjo on my knee. Bright eyes are gleaming with thy light.
We'll get further into the survey, this survey of American song, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air and the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Trevor Stevenson and our quartet of singers as we do this sampling of 200 years of American song, and this brings us well into the 19th century now. Romantic tragedies of American music. Stephen Foster dies at 37 with 38 cents in his pocket and a slip of paper that says, "Dear friends and gentle hearts."
Wow. Yeah, in New York City, yeah, in hard times for him, too. Publishing business had really gone down, and money was quite scarce.
There were some songwriters at that time, though, the Civil War, that were doing pretty well. One of them was George F. Root.
Right.
Best known for Tending on the Old Campground.
And the Battle Cry of Freedom.
Freedom.
But Tending on the Old Campground. And or New Campground sometimes. It gets mixed up.
It was somebody else's campground last night, but now it's ours.
Exactly. George Root published war songs during the war. They're quite successful, and we're going to do one of them here. And then the Battle Cry of Freedom will appear as a little snippet in the last Ives song that we'll do.
Charles Ives. I know we could go on. We could do a series of shows about Charles Ives, and I know you're a big fan of him. He was an innovator, and you say, "Oh, you're talking about music?" Well, not right away. I'm talking about insurance. Charles Ives had a big day job. He was an insurance executive. Created the concept of estate planning, which is popular with many of our broadcast institutions today. I think also created the concept of training insurance executives. He was one heck of a composer.
Right. A true American example, businessman, great composer, and an innovative composer taught by his father to be so. Charles Ives' father, George Edward Ives, was a virtuoso cornet player who ended up in the Union Army at the age of 17 and was in battle situations in the East, who came back from the war. He survived it. Set up shop and married and had a family in Danbury, Connecticut. And Charles Ives, the composer, is born about in 1874. So George Edward taught Charles Ives to play in one key while singing in another. The same song. And also they tuned their two pianos for experiment. They would tune the pianos a quarter step apart. And bitonality, polytonality was a big part of their language. It's hard to imagine this going on in the 1880s and all, in this little town in Connecticut, perhaps the most experimental think tank of all. And Charles Ives, one of his great memories is of childhood watching two bands come into town from the opposite ends of town playing different songs in different keys, and he's sitting on a hill trying to assemble it. And you can hear it in all of this music. It's incredible how he makes sense out of it.
I had, unbeknownst to me, one time two turntables going at the same time, and I thought I was playing Ives, but it was two different things going at the same time.
I think at one point he said, "What's wrong? Are my ears on backwards?"
He had trouble getting acceptance in the musical establishment. His father, though, I understand, was quite a cornet player.
Absolutely. And again, in the Union Army and then gone on through his life. And his father had played recitals of all Schubert songs, just cornet and piano, with no words with dizzying beauty as well. And the Ives pieces that we'll do here, the first one is a very avant-garde about a leopard in a cage pacing back and forth. There's also two little girls playing in the backyard in the second song. There is a "Shall We Gather at the River" with chords that perhaps even Oscar Peterson wouldn't have thought of. Amazingly innovative jazz chords to that. to the old hymn tune at the River, and then we'll end with a World War I song, He Is There, which has, of course, in Ives' inimitable fashion, all sorts of Civil War tunes piled in on top of it, and it's a big parade. And I will be joined at the bench for that one.
Oh,
by somebody.
Spoiler alert. Okay.
Yes.
George Root once, and then four from Charles Ives.
Right.
Just before the battle, mother, of you. While upon the field we're watching with the enemy in view, comrades brave around me lying, filled with thoughts of home and God, for well they know that on the sleep beneath the sun.
Farewell, mother,
you may never, mother,
press me to your heart again.
But oh, you'll not forget me, mother,
you will not forget me,
if I'm numbered with the slain.
Went around his cage from one side back to the other side. He stopped only when the keeper came around with meat. A boy who had been there 3 hours began to wonder. Life anything like that?
On sunny days in our backyard, two little flowers are seen, one dressed at times in brightest pink and one in green.
Crystal tide forever flowing. we'll gather at the river, the beautiful river. Yes, we'll gather at the river that flows by the throne of God.
Talented crew we have here.
bass singer and piccolo player, right, yeah.
So that's covered at Alpha and Omega there.
Yes, right. And I hope everyone could hear there's just all sorts of songs, you know, and with the national anthem quoted right at the end, you know, but in an off measure. I mean, it's really madness.
And yeah, Charles Ives did some, what shall we say, remarkable recordings of that song and some of his others.
Him so sing, playing yes. the piano and him singing
in a different key or something.
Oh, yeah. Who knows, right? Yeah. Right. Toward the end of his life, he made that recording, yeah. So.
We'll complete our survey of American song, 200 years of American song, right after this. You're listening to University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This weekend, we're celebrating American song on Wisconsin Public Radio with this special, which brings you pianist Trevor Stevenson and a talented quartet of singers as we look through 200 years of American song. There's a composer, actually pretty much a contemporary of Charles Ives, whose very name, I'll call it a name change over the course of time, yeah. says a lot about her career and, you might say, rising fortunes and things that she had to work against early on. Originally known, even I think in the 1970s when her recordings first really became known, or recordings of her music,
right.
known as Mrs. H.H.A. Beach. Right. But then gradually getting a fuller recognition as Amy Beach.
Right.
And sometimes considered the first major American woman composer.
Absolutely. She published during her lifetime. She was a great pianist. She's really a child prodigy pianist and did a lot of playing with orchestras and in chamber music and toured Europe and things like that. But she published. She wrote quite a bit of chamber music, symphonic works, and a lot of songs, which we'll hear a couple of them here. She lived mostly in Boston and was born, I guess, what you said.
I think 1867.
I think she and our next artist, Scott Joplin, are born around the same year.
Yes, that's right.
And absolutely stuck to her guns. And, you know, she is an American composer. She's not using American folk tunes or anything so much. She listened to a lot of Brahms and Schumann, you could tell. But she somehow weaves it into an American spell. We're so glad she took the trouble in a time when you read reviews of her music during her lifetime, it was just, you know, the things that we wish they hadn't have said, like, it's, you know, great music, but it's written by a woman. And it's awful to stomach. And
it's kind of a mixed blessing for us, in a sense, in that her arrangement with her husband, and I guess it wasn't all that unusual at the time, was that she was not to take lessons. She was not to teach piano.
Right.
And
exactly.
She could play only twice a year, and that had to be for charity because all those things were considered lower class.
Right.
And he was a very
wealthy
man.
He was a prominent doctor,
silver lining being that maybe that gave her more time for composing. And she did compose major things, symphonies and masses as well as songs.
Yeah, so a very, very an amazing figure. And we're going to do these two pieces that we'll do. One is a very short soprano and piano song based on a Robert Browning poem, which many people know, The Lark, The Years in the Spring, the Lark's on the Wing, and, you know, God's in His Heaven, All's Right with the World. A wonderful setting in the key of D flat. And then Peace Be With You, a very spiritual a cappella quartet setting after that. Amy Beach.
The years and the spring and the days and the morn, mornings and seven, the hillsides to burn. The years and the spring and the days and the morn, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn, God's in His hem, God's in His hem, all's right, all's right with the world.
Well, there's one composer whose years really pretty much define a whole little era of music, if we say 1898 to 1917.
Right, Scott Joplin, right, born in Texas, and his father was a freed slave, his mother was, you know, cleaning houses, but this is right after the Civil War. And Scott Joplin was free, to, you know, somewhat free to travel in those days, even through the South. And musicians were gathering in all sorts of interesting places, particularly tied to railroad towns. And he ends up at the Chicago World's Fair, 1893, and then in Sedalia, Missouri, where the two of the big railroad lines cross. Musicians were, you know, could work in all sorts of taverns and other things like that, churches and taverns. And he did, but also a new style was emerging. It was, they eventually called it ragtime. They were mixing a left hand of marches and quadrilles with the syncopated melodic material from the Caribbean and African influences, and fusing these into this incredibly infectious style, with rhythmic drive and then also, you know, kind of a floating, feathering melody that moves quite quickly in most cases. Joplin writes the Maple Leaf Rag around 1897, 1898 in Sedalia, Missouri. John Stark, a publisher, picks it up. Joplin is smart enough to not give away the rights to it, greatest rag ever written, and it actually gets royalties throughout his life. And one story I just must share about Scott Joplin toward the end of his life in New York City, this is told by a friend of his, and Joplin had taken the friend to the train station for some journey. And Joplin, as the man's getting on the train, hands him a silver dollar. And his friend says, thank you, but I don't need money. I'm okay right now. And Joplin says, no, look at the coin carefully. And the guy says, okay, yeah. Joplin says, look at the date. And the guy says, yes, 1897. And according to the friend, Joplin stared him right in the eye and said, that's the year I wrote the Maple Leaf Rag, and with an unforgettable look on his face.
That started ragtime.
Exactly.
It's hard not to smile when you hear ragtime. It just kind of lights up the room, doesn't it?
Yeah. Apparently, yeah, Joplin had a kid with him that would dance this often. Imagine. Yeah.
Imagine, yes. And we're not more than, speaking of dancing, skip and a jump away from that most American of institutions, Broadway. By the time we get to Joplin, 1917, the end really of the ragtime era,
right.
Really just a few years until you have this real blossoming of musical theater in America.
The Gershwin brothers are coming, and all sorts of great Broadway is hits in the 20s.
Yeah.
And And we will, the next song is by Richard Rodgers with his first lyricist partner, Lawrence Hart, from a show comes in around in 1930 called Babes in Arms. And it's a famous song. Everyone knows it. It's My Funny Valentine. Just beautiful fusion of lyrics and tune. It's set in the key of great gravitas, C minor, you know. So how's that for a Valentine's present?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, right. So we'll do that. And then followed by Cole Porter, Anything Goes, which also is in C minor, moving to C major. And the Porter, of course, his genius in this song is talking about how times have changed. And what used to be risque is now just every day. And of course, that clock continues to move on. Right.
And he sang versions of it that were risque, just for fun. Yeah. I mean, he had constant fun with this song.
There's a recording of Porter singing about eight verses of this, with all stepping on all sorts of contemporaries of his time. Right. So anyway, we'll do Funny Valentine, and then Anything Goes. We'll bring back the quartet.
Behold the way our fine feathered friend his virtue doth parade. Thou knowest not, my dim-witted friend, the picture thou hast made. Thy vacant brow and thy tousled hair conceal thy good intent. Thou noble, upright, truthful, sincere, and slightly dobigent, you, my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
Times have changed, and we've often rewound the clock. Since the Puritans got a shock when they landed on Plymouth Rock, if today any shock we should try to stem, instead of landing on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock would land on them.
Olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked at as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors too, who once knew better words, now only use for latter words read in prose. Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today. One must die today, the women lies today, are just silly gigolos. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that you're bound to answer when I propose. Anything goes.
Uh, I hope you've enjoyed this 200-year exploration of American song, and many thanks to Trevor Stevenson and our gifted singers. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me the next time around for University of the Air here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.